Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Open Wounds, the story of racial tragedy, trauma, and redemption by Phil Allen Jr. Narrated by Terrence Kidd. Part 1. Telling Tragedy. Introduction. Telling a Tragedy. Racism is a thief and a murderer, a deserter of all that is good. It preys on bodies of color, even while a body of color preys. The darker the skin, the more destructive is the pursuit of this kind of sin. For most of my life, he was a ghost, a mythical figure, maybe even a figment of my family's collective imagination. There were no pictures of him around the house, or hidden away in some dust-covered trunk serving as a treasure chest of ancestral memorabilia. There was never any conversation about him over the course of my life until I reached the age of 42. I was left to take the morsels of comments about him sporadically shared throughout the years and pieced together the biography of my grandfather. To relieve the secret anxiety and curiosity I had as I grew older, I attempted to convince myself that he never existed in the first place. However, this was in vain. All my life I created an image of my grandfather. This image was not based on who I knew him to be, or what I heard about him, but instead based on who I hoped he would have been in my life had he been alive. I would wonder how different or the same the grandfather I never knew would have been compared with the only living grandfather who played a role in my upbringing. I wondered how much of my father was like him. I wouldn't say it was painful at the time, but I knew there was a void in my family. I knew I yearned for answers. I have come to learn that my father had to do the same thing. Imagine who his father would have been to him. It became clear to me that he also felt the same as I did. He wanted to have answers to fill the void. He and I both needed a figurative gauze to cover the open wound so that healing might begin. A tragic story. What should have been a day of worship and gratitude for God's blessings and mercy turned out to be a day of mourning. On Sunday, January 29, 1933, undoubtedly a cold southern day, my maternal great-grandfather, Bruce Harper, was killed in Alabama while traveling in search of work during the height of the Great Depression. Always vulnerable to the racial climate, he was pushed off a train to a violent death. Uncertain if he was traveling to or from Alabama back to South Carolina, what was certain is that he would never see his baby girl grow up. My grandmother was just 2 years old in 1933 when her father was killed. She had no memory of him. White supremacy not only snuffed out the full-grown body of her father, but also caused an abortion of nascent memories of father-daughter moments before they could fully develop in her mind. This was not the only time a man in my family was killed at the hands of racism. Barely a generation later, in 1953, Nathaniel Nate Allen, my paternal grandfather, was murdered in the Sanpit River of Georgetown, South Carolina. His body was found after a few days submerged underwater, lying face down in the river with a bullet hole in the back of his head, or in his back, depending on which version of the story one hears. An apparent altercation between him and three white men led to my grandfather's attempt to escape a gun pointed directly at him. He never made it to the refuge of the river that he hoped would save his life. Two fathers were taken from their homes and families because the color of their skin rendered them vulnerable in a culture that perpetuated racially motivated injustices. In 1930s and 1950s America, racism was able to flourish because black men's ancestral heritage was despised by white racists in a nation with a history of trauma from bigotry, systemic inequities, and a cultural ethos. However, these events are not just about what happened to a single family over 60 years ago. This is a story that reflects what was indicative of the times my grandfather and great-grandfather lived in. It is about the legacy that such practices have left for us to navigate and attempt to heal from even today. This is about the need to connect the dots between the blatancy of our racist past and both the obvious and the insidious subtleties of our racist present. To show how trauma has transgenerational and intergenerational effects, particularly on African-American families, and particularly on African-American sons like me. Truth Born Again. I was in my late 30s when I summoned the courage to initiate a much-needed conversation with my paternal grandmother, Rebecca Allen Young. I asked her about the details surrounding my grandfather's death. She was visibly upset by the idea of a conversation, reliving arguably the most painful time in her life. I could see the tightness in her face and the clutching of her hands as she tried to avoid the question. In that moment, I recognized the lasting trauma that persisted not only in my grandmother, but most likely as an undercurrent for my whole family. For my grandmother, it did not matter that I wanted to learn more about who my grandfather may or may not have been. Her emotional response to my genuine curiosity to know about our family history and the events surrounding my grandfather's passing was telling of the horror I was asking her to relive. It was not until less than a year from her passing that I revisited the question, hoping for her to have a conversation rather than shutting it down. It comes as no surprise to me that my father never spoke about his father to me or my siblings our entire lives until just a couple of years before the writing of this book. I have long believed the absence of his father and the reason for his absence in our lives was the root of his choosing to medicate in self-destructive ways for decades. Open wounds require attention. Neither silence nor amnesia is a healthy or sufficient way to respond to physical, emotional, or mental violation, no matter how far in the past they may have occurred. For all these reasons and more, my hopes for this book and any corresponding projects on this matter are the following. 1. That healing for my family can begin in some ways and deepen in others. 2. That the countless African-American families with similar stories as far back as the Jim Crow lynching era and as recent as the families of Trayvon Martin or Ahmaud Arbery may be inspired to tell their stories as well. And 3. That this story becomes a catalyst for understanding the larger narrative of intergenerational trauma from racism leading to concrete progress toward racial solidarity in America. In response to the discourse of racism, the system, that is grounded in white supremacy, the undergirding ideology or spirit, and manifested in tragic ways such as slavery and Jim Crow, white people tend to insist on forgetting about the past and just moving on. This is a dangerous proposition. Some people do not realize that we are living out the legacy of our past every day. The events of 150 years ago, at the tail end of slavery, still have effects in our present. The physical and psychological residues of white supremacy are present in the self-perception of both white and black people, as well as these groups' perceptions of each other. The tension is present and further thickens with every act of bigotry or perceived racism across this nation. Events today do not stand alone. They are but pieces of a historical puzzle of events that form a picture of the cultural ethos of the United States. Each and every one of these events, like those of the past, is a traumatic experience that does not just go away when we close our eyes and plug our ears. As a case in point, to this day, my father and his siblings have carried the trauma of losing a father to a racist act that culminated in the injustice of a lie written and authenticated on his death certificate. Intergenerational trauma is the overarching theme that hovers over the tragic events surrounding my grandfather's murder. I received what my father carried and passed on to my siblings and me, whether consciously or not. He received the trauma of an absent father due to racial injustice. I inherited the pain of my father and grandmother. Without healing in our family, the next generation will inherit the same. They will take the baton of bitterness and continue a never-ending sprint to the finish line of toxicity, despair, and a false sense of wholeness. They will literally carry the trauma in their bodies. As such, I hope to uncover not only how events of the past have shaped individuals and groups, but also how events, laws, policies, and narratives have deformed our physiological and cultural DNA. Central to this malformed social genetic code is the imposition of whiteness. I want to examine the ideology and principality of whiteness. This is not so much a discussion of white persons of particular ethnic groups with white skin, although white people are the primary agents of whiteness, but a way of thinking and being in the world, especially from a position of or an association with power. The end goal for this book and corresponding project is redemption. A friend of mine mentioned to me on social media that she was curious to see how redemption would look. My grandfather's name and life are deserving of redemption. My grandfather's service in the U.S. Navy is deserving of recognition. The details of the events surrounding his murder, which will likely never be resolved due to time and the deaths of many of those involved 67 years ago, deserve to be heard. Redemption is in the healing of a son who lost his father at 2 years old and has medicated with violence, drugs, and alcohol for most of his life. Redemption is Nate Allen's name intertwined in his grandson's quest to facilitate racial justice and solidarity. The hope is that his death was not in vain. Instead, it will become a catalytic episode within the narrative of justice and the work of solidarity, though delayed by several decades. Ultimately, although unlikely, redemption is the reopening of my grandfather's cold case to publicly declare the correct cause of his death. Redemption is inspiring more stories that lie dormant on the basement floors of the hearts and minds of families who have experienced such injustice without anyone being held accountable. Redemption is when the nation is forced to look more deeply into its past and understand its links to the present and future, leading to genuine collective repentance. Redemption is restorative justice for African American families who have had property, opportunities, and persons taken away from them while permitted by the complicity of U.S. institutions and agencies. Redemption is racial solidarity from the shared lament and practices that transcend race and seek to eradicate the residue of a racist past that continues to exert its influence on us today. When Calling Calls. I recently spoke with a fellow seminarian and classmate, Ines Velasquez McBride, who was in attendance when I first shared these thoughts about my grandfather's death in a class we took together. She not only confirmed what I thought people felt about it, but also shared even more profound thoughts about that moment. She said, "It was your lived faith, the historicity of race in your family, an embodied theology, a calling and conviction of healing and reconciliation. More than anything, I was also moved that your call to heal wounds and out of your healing, a tidal wave of healing to others. It's lived witness. It's testimony. The story itself hits our wombs and hearts as it does, as you tell it. Your story brought us near you because it moved us towards love and solidarity. That's what storytelling does. An untold story never heals." That was catalytic storytelling that day in class, in the presence of many witnesses. In addition to Ines's comments, what deeply moved me was the authentically visceral response by my white classmates to the tragedy of racial injustice that happened to my family over 60 years ago. The moment was mutually enlightening. They caught a glimpse of the country's history in real time that made it palpable for them. They could now touch it. Yet it was just as illuminating for me to see the lament from my white brothers and sisters, as well as those of other racial backgrounds in the class. It taught me that there are some who are receptive, even if they do not fully understand the depth of pain of such an event and history. They played a critical role in this newly amplified voice of mine. There was a calling out that unfolded in that moment, a beckoning from God giving me permission to speak these painful truths about history and its legacy even beyond my own family's narrative. This was an opportunity to become a conduit for healing wounds, my own, my father's, my people's, and even white folks, who assume that they have been immune to the trauma of racism and that their social DNA remains unaffected by its influence. I've learned that this is what God does, calls one out to a new season of uncertain terrain through events and interactions as we live out our faith. There isn't always an audible, like, word from the Lord that floors a person and confirms that it is indeed a divine calling. There are times when the moment, as it unfolds, is the summoning to a necessary new life trajectory, one with personal, spiritual, and social implications. I cannot unhear this summon. All I could do is respond by inviting you to bear witness to the various open wounds that my body still bears and, in doing so, move toward healing. Healing requires all hands on deck. It will take more than just well wishes and apologies. It takes solidarity. This calling I speak of mandates a communal effort that transcends racial lines. It is rejoicing together, grieving together, and fighting together. The balm to close and heal these wounds is found in a community where we stand in solidarity, resisting oppressive ideologies, attitudes, actions, and structures that caused the wounds in the first place. The title of this book has multiple meanings attached to it. Open Wounds is in regard to the nostalgic, the tragic, and the catalytic events that have left unattended scars. After my grandfather was killed, my grandmother was never the same. It was a traumatic event that required the rest of her life and ultimately death before she was ever free from the pain of her wounds. Once my father, at 9 years old, found out how his father was killed, he became a person riddled with rage and hatred. He sought self-destructive painkillers in the form of drugs, violence, and women to numb the pain from this loss. Ever since my grandmother gave me the gift of conversation centered on my grandfather's death, it sparked more than a curiosity to learn more. It fueled a fire in me to allow this tragic family history to be a catalyst for a greater narrative and cause with healing potential. I borrow from Martin Luther King Jr.'s idea that suffering can be redemptive and trauma can be fuel for moral agency. Open Wounds is about more than tragedy. It is about resiliency. Chapter 1. Before Emmett Till. Nate Allen. Strange fruit doesn't always hang from poplar trees. Sometimes they fall from branches and limbs, and they lie forgotten on the ground, left to spoil and waste away. They are shot down and left to float in rivers until the rivers vomit them to the shores and docks like a generation of Jonas expelled from the belly of a fish called whiteness. They are left to rot in the dark of the night, in the silence of blind eyes, in the deafness of closed ears. Their lifeless eyes stare at the earth as the dirt from which they are formed beckons them. This particular day in class, we were watching a segment of the miniseries Eyes on the Prize about the civil rights movement and the events that inspired it. There was a picture on the screen of Emmett Till lying in his casket. His face, disfigured and unrecognizable, was displayed so that the world could see what anti-black racism from white supremacy had done to a 14-year-old African-American kid. Till was a teenager from Chicago who was visiting family in Money, Mississippi over the summer of 1954. Apparently, Till had whistled at or said, "Hey, baby," to a white woman. During that time, it was forbidden for a black man or boy to address a white woman in any way other than submissively and respectfully. Other ways would have been cause for death. Till was killed by the woman's husband and brother, who were acquitted of the murder. They later admitted in an interview, protected by the law of double jeopardy, that they had indeed killed him. Watching this film about Till's death, I was composed on the outside, but I grieved internally. I wasn't sure why revisiting a picture I had been familiar with since I was Till's age had stirred me up as much as it had. But rather than seeing Till, I saw my grandfather. I had no idea these emotions about my grandfather's death were just beneath the surface of my conscience. All it would take was an image in a documentary to bring them to the surface. My stomach would begin to feel unsettled. My eyes would dampen with tears too stubborn to remain hidden. My emotions danced back and forth between anger and sadness. Little did I know that for the first time, I was about to publicly disclose my family's trauma in a classroom full of strangers, unsure if they would even care. This classroom represents the delivery room for the birth of a story with a tragic beginning, but a redemptive ending. I couldn't wait to take this class. I'd anticipated it answering so many of my questions about one of the most important African-American figures in U.S. history. When I researched seminaries where I could pursue a master's degree in theology, I visited Fuller Theological Seminary's website and saw Dr. Hock June Lee's class entitled Theology and Ethics of Martin Luther King, Jr. This class and Dr. Lee's background as a King scholar were major factors in my desire to attend Fuller Seminary. Just a year or so before I watched this film in class, my grandmother had spoken with me about my grandfather and his death for the first time in my life after rejecting my previous attempt at a conversation about him a decade earlier. This was when I first learned how he was killed and that the location and circumstances around Till's murder were so similar to my grandfather's. Hearing the details gripped me. I had this inner turmoil of contentment because I finally had information, and bitterness because of the reality of how he died. And now here I was in a graduate course on the theology and ethics of one of my heroes, Martin Luther King, Jr., wrestling with the overlap between my families and our nation's struggle to reconcile racism and coexistence. After viewing the video for a few minutes as a class, Dr. Lee asked us to break into small groups to discuss how we were feeling and to share our thoughts with classmates. When it was time for me to share, these words came out of my mouth. I can't look at the pictures of Emmett Till without seeing my grandfather. I had never even thought of those words before, much less spoken them. It was as if they were there the whole time and I was unaware, but the time had come for that statement to be pronounced. I felt this deep sense of vulnerability and empowerment simultaneously. I could breathe after making the statement. Figuratively speaking, I unknowingly had been holding my breath all my life about everything that surrounded my grandfather's mysterious absence. That day, I finally put words and a voice to how I felt about any reminder of his death. As three of my peers listened to me share in improvisational fashion what I had known at the time about my grandfather's death, there was stillness in the moment. It was as if I was thinking and speaking in slow motion, moved by my own words as they unfolded. As they listened intently to my story, I saw moisture begin to fill their eyes and spill onto their cheeks, leaving streaks of tears down their faces. This was a new experience for me. Folks, white folks, were more than interested in my story. They were moved to lament. The gamut of responses ranged from shock to sadness. This was not entertainment that provoked mere pity, but a truth that elicited profound emotion. After a few minutes of our small group conversation, Dr. Lee reconvened the class and requested volunteers' reflections. I volunteered to share what I told my small group. Once again, I was taken aback by the visceral responses of my classmates. They were more than concerned. They had been moved deeply. The best thing about it was that they were not trying to fix anything. They sat in the grief, shock, and discomfort, and for some, I would imagine, anger. In retrospect, I suppose their collective response resulted because in that moment, they were able to connect more intimately to the Till incident of 1954. To have in the room the grandson of a man who was killed in a similar fashion just over a year apart from Till brought all of us closer to the reality of the horror and pain of racial injustice. Suddenly, it didn't seem so long ago. It was in that moment that I understood I needed to tell this story. The story of the conflated histories of my family, Black Americans, and the United States needed to be articulated in a way where the dots could be connected between the past and its legacy, our present ethos. It was in that moment in Dr. Lee's class that the word calling took on a whole new meaning for me. No longer was I confined to the pulpit on Sunday mornings, nor was my message of racial justice and the work required for racial solidarity prohibited from the pulpit. In that moment, my voice had been awakened to a broader mission in the world. There was a clarion call to preach the gospel, not just in the generic evangelical sense, to save souls by evangelizing, but also to bring attention to the ways that the gospel speaks to the particularities of groups of people like mine, who must navigate social structures that produce inequities and injustices. Just as Abel's blood was said to have been calling out to God from the earth, my grandfather's blood, though diluted with salt water from the Sandpit River, was no longer muted, but had been calling out to his grandson to tell his story. His story, and many like it, is the reason we ought to be preaching the gospel. I could no longer circumvent these realities and parse the gospel from justice in such a way that I render it impotent simply because factions of the U.S. American church lack the imagination to see its relevance to forming our individual and collective responses to injustice. Nate Allen's blood calls out to me in symphony with the spirit to commit myself to redeeming his honor and restoring my family and the community that endured this tragedy to wholeness by telling this story. In my culture, ancestral witness inspires how we live today, as well as how we witness back to our ancestors through the same personal and communal ethics. In other words, honoring the legacy and names of our ancestors is central to Black lives. This honor is not intended to compete with witnessing on behalf of Jesus, but it includes the role that the lives, influence, and wisdom of our ancestors play in the lives of their descendants today. Why we can't forget the past. I heard a politician on a major television news network ask the question, can't we forget the past and move on? Slavery was so long ago. It is apparent to me that far too many people in America equate racism with slavery alone, as if the 90 years of Jim Crow following the end of 246 years of institutional slavery and the 12 years of Reconstruction somehow immediately made the nation post-racial. This idea of racial inequality is said and done, is the result of either historical ignorance of the Jim Crow era ethos, or the discomfort that comes with having to acknowledge the residue of the past in the present. This confrontation of history is disruptive. It is disruptive to comfort. It is disruptive to the idealistic view of America. It is disruptive to many white people's self-perceptions when they are forced to concede that they have been passive beneficiaries of an unjust system tilted in their favor. When someone else posed that politician's question to me in person a few years ago, I remember thinking, and later shared with them, you evoke slavery every time.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?